This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, as counting gets underway in elections in Northern Ireland, can political stability return to the province following the most tense political crisis since the Good Friday Peace Agreement was signed almost 20 years ago? Or will the outcome mean further political stalemate that could result in direct rule being reimposed from London? Women are weaker, smaller and less intelligent than men and therefore should be paid less than men. No, I'm not reading from a decades-old manuscript. Those are the actual words of an actual member of the European Parliament today. The opinion of one individual or proof that sexism in politics is still rife. Attempts this week to progress the UN-sponsored peace talks on Syria appear to have foundered amid allegations that the main Syrian umbrella opposition group was trying to sabotage negotiations. But with separate negotiations due to take place later this month in Kazakhstan, is the UN's role as a peace broker in the Syrian conflict become irrelevant? The United States is to begin updating its stock of underground atomic bombs as part of its so-called nuclear sponge mission. We'll be taking a closer look at what the nuclear sponge is and why it could prove to be, for the people of five Midwest states, apocalyptic. And we'll be speaking about Freddy and Bubbles, who were given a Viking send-off like no other you have ever seen before. All of that and more over the next hour on this Friday edition of World in Focus. 2 decades on since the Anglo-Irish Good Friday Peace Agreement was signed, and voters in Northern Ireland are awaiting the results of a snap election that could make or break their fragile political process and result in direct rule from London being once again imposed. Although the full results won't be known until late Saturday, the outcome could prove the biggest test to the peace process since the Anglo-Irish conflict, known as the Troubles, came to an end in 1998. Our reporter Mark Hurst has this report.
Counting is underway in Northern Ireland following a snap election that could drastically alter the political makeup of the devolved Stormont Assembly. In January, the Irish Republican Party, Sinn Féin, effectively collapsed the power-sharing executive coalition. They shared power with the pro-British Democratic Unionist Party, but decided to withdraw from the coalition amid allegations of corruption involving the DUP's First Minister, Arlene Foster. Political tensions are now at their most strained since the Good Friday Peace Agreement was signed almost 20 years ago. That peace deal brought to an end more than 3 decades of conflict in the province. So will this latest election restore political stability to the north of Ireland? That's a question I put earlier today to Ivanka Antova, a candidate in the election who is representing the leftist People Before Profits Alliance.
At this time of the day, when the counts are still coming in, it's difficult to say what the elections are going to bring exactly. But I can tell you what we've already observed, which is a significant disturbance of the status quo in Northern Irish politics. The so-called small parties or opposition parties that I personally call progressive parties have scored very well. We have not made any losses. If anything, People Before Profit at the moment is making an advance, particularly in the areas where we're running for the first time. So what this is going to bring, I hope, is a new page in a very long conversation. It's going to bring people an opportunity to imagine a different type of future for Northern Irish politics, and the stability will depend on many things in the future that at the moment I find unable to give a prediction about.
And many of the political parties contesting this election are doing so either on an anti-corruption or anti-austerity agenda. Has that been the dominating issue of this election, and how much will that resonate with voters across the north of Ireland?
Amongst the reasons that led to the snap elections were certainly the RHI scandal, this scheme that could have been a good idea had it been handled in a more open, transparent and competent way. Corruption, a lack of political integrity, broken promises are certainly amongst the reasons for snap elections and for people being angry at the establishment and sending, in my view, a clear message that things cannot go the way they've been going. It certainly resonates with people when we go canvassing door to door. Corruption is one of the themes that comes across very often, as it does austerity, as do cuts to benefits, as do the very low standard of living for some of the most marginalized communities in the North. So these are definitely issues that resonate with voters and that prompt them to hopefully rethink their vote and vote for the progressive parties rather than the establishment.
And political opinion in the North seems as divided as ever. How does the People Before Profits Alliance think that divide can be overcome? I appreciate any solution is not going to be a quick one, but how do you overcome that?
People Before Profit is a non-sectarian, non-racist, anti-establishment, anti-status quo socialist party. So our solution to the plight of austerity, the plight of division between workers, division between communities, is to build a very strong working class voice in the North that transcends the orange versus green division that is in many ways artificially imposed on people. It's been noted on numerous occasions that Stormont is way behind the people of Northern Ireland in terms of progressive politics. The ordinary citizens, the ordinary voters, all of us workers and people living here realize that the divisions that are being peddled by the establishment as their justification to stay in power are not divisions that we bring amongst ourselves. Our response, People Before Profit's response to division, is to build grassroots movement, is to strengthen the voice of the marginalized, is to amplify what we think is a very human and much more audible desire to progress and to move beyond orange versus green sectarian politics and to embrace class unity, socialist principles, and a better future.
Ivanka Antova, many thanks for speaking to us on World in Focus today. Thank you.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories all in one place. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
6 minutes past the hour, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. I'm Carolyn Scott. A debate about sexism in politics has been sparked today following the comments by the Polish member of the European Parliament, Janusz Korwin-Mikke. And, well, just have a listen to it for yourself.
And of course women must earn less than men because they are weaker, they are smaller, they are less intelligent, and they must earn less. That's all.
That was Janusz Korwin-Mikke, the Polish MEP, speaking in the European Parliament. If that's the first time you've heard that, then, like me, you might be thinking, no, that can't be right. Did I mishear that? Well, just in case, here it is again.
And of course, women must earn less than men because they are weaker, they are smaller, they are less intelligent, and they must earn less. That's all.
And no, that's not archived footage. That's an actual comment by an actual MEP today in the European Parliament. In 2017, an MEP stood up and said, women should earn less as they are weaker, smaller and less intelligent. He was met with an immediate response from the Spanish MEP, Eratea García Pérez, of which we've got a short translation.
Mire, señor diputado.
Look, according to your theory, I should not have the right to be here as a member of this parliament. And I know it hurts you, I know it hurts and worries you that today women can sit in this house and represent European citizens with the same rights as you. I am here to defend all European women from men like you. That was the response by the Spanish MEP, Eratea García Pérez. For those who know Mr. Korwin-Mikke may not be entirely surprised by his comments. The MEP was previously suspended for 5 days for comparing Europe's influx of migrants, refugees and asylum seekers to excrement. In 2015, he was suspended for 10 days alongside the Italian MEP Gianluca Bionano for making a Nazi salute. It has not been announced yet whether he'll face any punishment for today's remarks. He did provide evidence for his comments today. He said that in the Polish Theoretical Physics Olympiad, women didn't feature in the top 800, and that in the World Chess Championships, there's not a single woman in the top 100. And that is why, he says, women should earn less as they're weaker, smaller and less intelligent. Earlier today I spoke to Jenny Gunn, a prominent activist and candidate in the Scottish parliamentary elections for Rise Scotland's Left Alliance. I asked Jenny what her initial reaction was to the comments made by Mr. Korwin-Mikke.
Initial reaction is one of sort of disbelief. I know that women in politics still face insurmountable challenges and microaggressions and a lot of rampant sexism, but I think that's probably the most clear example of outright misogyny that we've seen in a parliament in a long, long time. It's absolutely shocking. And the member from from Spain did a good job of shooting him down. But yeah, it was absolutely disgusting, actually.
He used as evidence to support his statement the fact that there are no women in the top 100 chess players in the world. I mean, that's got to be some tough evidence to fight back at, Jenny.
Oh, well, it's absolute nonsense. I mean, like, it's just like evidence of top chess players being what, a sign of ability to lead, ability to what? I mean, it's just absolute nonsense. I mean, I'd hazard a guess that the top chess players in the world as well are probably from specific countries, but Russia, China, where it's national sport. So does that mean that somehow Russian and Chinese men are smarter than others? I don't understand that.
I think a lot of people were surprised to hear this within a European Parliament, given that within the EU there have been quite a lot of good moves towards gender equality. Now, you're active in politics in Scotland. Are you yourself, have you experienced any sexism or abuse because of your gender for being active in politics?
Yeah, absolutely. When I stood in the Scottish Parliament elections last year, there was a lot of this sort of like very condescending language, getting called sweetheart and dear and really feeling just like inadequate compared to other men that were standing. A lot of the hustings I did, I was the only person under 30 and the only female there, and online abuse, I mean, that's particularly been in the media a lot recently, but sort of gendered terms to describe me and threats about things like sexual assault and rape and all the rest of it, which is par for the course, it seems, for women in politics these days, although it shouldn't be. So yeah, I've definitely experienced it. I think, to be honest, I'm lucky in Scotland to be surrounded by so many amazing women who have sort of forged a path towards gender equality and have had their voices heard within a parliament and within activism in Scotland, but we've still got a long way to go in changing attitudes towards women in activism and in politics.
There must be some hope that that's happening, given the reaction there's been to the comments by Yanis Korwin-Mikke. The reaction has been quite stark online. A lot of people have been hitting out against his comments. He was immediately challenged in the Parliament by Ms. Garcia Perez, the Spanish MEP, and she seems to have gotten quite a lot of support from this. That must give you some hope that there is a future, that gender equality is going in the right direction.
Yeah, it does, and I definitely think we are going in the right direction, but I just think that we can't be complacent. I mean, this outright misogyny that this Polish MEP has come out with this week is clearly like a very stark reminder that not everybody kind of thinks the same way as we do about gender equality. And even though legislation and the sort of symbolic women in power, the women that have come to power across Europe and in Scotland, particularly with the First Minister and our three big party leaders being women, is all to the good. But I think that we can't be complacent, because misogyny and violence against women and the way women are degraded is so ingrained into our society that without a sort of social change about how we think about gender and how we think about women, I don't think very much will change. I am hopeful, and it's nice to see, but I think that we've still got a lot of work left to do.
Well, Jenny Gunn, thank you very much for joining us on World in Focus.
You're very welcome.
That was Jenny Gunn, an activist and former parliamentary candidate for Rise, Scotland's Left Alliance, speaking to me earlier today. I also spoke earlier with Dr. Kay Reynolds, a professor at the University of Huddersfield, who has written extensively about women in politics and feminist ethics. I asked Dr. Reynolds if, despite there having been major progress made with regards to gender equality and women in politics across the EU, that these comments suggest that there was certainly still a lot of work to be done.
Yes, I would agree with you there. That, yeah, on the one hand, we see that strides have been made, but on the other hand, we see some frightening trends in some areas. For example, what the Polish MEP said today, I think with some of the behaviors and statements we've observed from the new United States president, I think in some ways we recognize that there's been progress. But in other places, sometimes you hear sort of the rhetoric or the narrative that you women, you've made so much progress. You have everything now. What else do you want? But statements like these and other behaviors that we observe in the news are clear evidence that there's still quite a long way to go.
These statements from Yanis Korwin-Mikke, I mean, this is an MEP who has come under criticism a great deal in the past. He was penalised by the Parliament for making Nazi salutes. He is not far from controversy at any point. But should we be looking at this as a freak comment by somebody who is seen as being quite outrageous at times? Or is this actually representative of an underlying rhetoric that perhaps just doesn't raise its head that often?
Oh, I think you could interpret it in either of those methods that you just described. I wouldn't put it too far from a person in his position to actually have a desire to spark controversy. It's been said amongst my colleagues and in academic literature that you can't change anything if there is no controversy. If everybody sits around and agrees with each other, then we cannot enact change. And even if that controversy incites shock and appall, it nevertheless brings issues to the table. So while we can be shocked and appalled at statements like this or behaviors such as using the Nazi salute, it nevertheless brings these issues into a public discourse and a public dialogue, which is important then to tease out and to get people thinking about these issues.
Mm-hmm. And are you hopeful that perhaps when we hear the extremes such as what we've heard in the parliament today, that it just inspires people to perhaps take a stance against it?
Absolutely. I would hope so. I would say it's a shame that that type of action didn't take place before this person or people who publicly display these types of attitudes and are actually elected leaders and role models. It's a shame that action didn't take place before they were elected. But it's a sign, I think, to the rest of us to recognize that those opinions are out there and that those leaders and representatives that are in office may not be the only ones who hold those kinds of opinions, so that there is work still to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Reynolds, thank you very much for joining us today. It's great to have your thoughts on that.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was Dr. Kay Reynolds, professor at the University of Huddersfield, speaking to me about the comments made by the Polish MEP Janusz Korwin-Mikke that women are smaller, weaker and less intelligent than men. And for balance, we did try to interview someone who agreed with Mr. Korwin-Mikke, but unfortunately no one from 1830 was available.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, attempts this week to progress UN-sponsored peace talks on Syria appear to have foundered amid allegations that the main Syrian umbrella opposition group was trying to sabotage negotiations. But with separate negotiations due to take place later this month in Kazakhstan, is the UN's role as a peace broker in the Syrian conflict become irrelevant? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
I'm Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not, you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik. Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists
Learn what really makes the decision makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, attempts this week to progress the UN-sponsored peace talks on Syria appear to have foundered amid allegations that the main Syrian umbrella opposition group were trying to sabotage negotiations. But with separate negotiations due to take place later this month in Kazakhstan, has the UN's role as a peace broker in the Syrian conflict become irrelevant? The United States is to begin updating its stock of underground atomic bombs as part of its so-called nuclear sponge mission. We'll be taking a closer look at what the nuclear sponge is and why it could prove to be, for the people of five Midwest states, apocalyptic. With less than 2 weeks until the Dutch general election, many commentators are predicting a shift toward far-right populism in the Netherlands following the rise of Geert Wilders' Freedom Party. But has the Wilders phenomenon been overblown? And why is nobody talking about the simultaneous surge in support for the left-leaning pro-Europe parties? And we'll also be speaking about Freddy and Bubbles, who are giving a Viking send-off like no other you have ever seen before. Efforts to reach a United Nations brokered peace deal in Geneva between the opposing sides in the Syrian conflict this week appear to have stalled amid acrimonious accusations that the Syrian rebel groups are trying to sabotage talks. But are the UN's efforts and lack of progress in Geneva further evidence that the international body needs a root and branch reform to help the institution rebuild its reputation and credibility? Our reporter Mark Kirst has been looking at the latest developments.
On Thursday, Maria Zakharova, spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry, told reporters that the Syrian opposition High Negotiations Committee is trying to sabotage peace talks in Geneva. The committee, which consists of a broad umbrella of Syrian opposition groups, refused to engage in direct talks initiated by the United Nations, leading to growing speculation that the negotiations are becoming a sideshow to more substantive talks due to be held in the Kazakh capital of Astana later this month. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Professor Hans Kochler, President of the International Progress Organization, a body that advises and consults with the United Nations on international relations. Professor Kochler, there have been ongoing efforts in Switzerland this week to try and get talks started, but these appear to have stalled. What's your assessment of the Geneva talks, and are they a sideshow to the more substantive Russian-instigated negotiations that are set to continue in Astana later this month?
I'm not very optimistic about the Geneva negotiations for two particular reasons. First, the framework is on the basis of the United Nations organization. The UN is the sponsor of the meetings, and there is no consensus among the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council on basic issues. And there is in particular no understanding, as at this moment, between Russia and the United States. That's why I think that the UN cannot provide an efficient framework, as the Security Council cannot produce a binding resolution on the basis of Chapter 7, which would require consensus among the permanent members, including the US and Russia. And the second reason or second aspect why I think the prospects are rather dim is that there is still no cohesive position, or there is no unified group of the opposition or resistance, and those who claim to represent the opposition and the resistance in Geneva are the ones, are the groups based in Saudi Arabia. I think the Astana format has better chances of producing progress because it is sponsored by those powers that are already or that have an influence in Syria on the ground and that are also in a certain sense regional countries. And we have seen that the Astana format was able to produce a framework to monitor the ceasefire, and it has also been able to integrate or to have as participants representatives of those opposition groups who are on the ground in Syria, I mean, who are actively involved in the or who are part of the fighting units and who are not somewhere away based in some other countries and would not have an influence on those who fight. Because if ever there is a chance for peace in negotiations, those have to be undertaken between the warring parties.
And earlier this week, you gave a lecture in Berlin in which you said the transition in Syria from general civil unrest to full-blown civil war was the result of what you describe as, quotes, covert foreign actors. Specifically, who were you referring to there?
It is mainly certain countries in the region, plus countries from outside the region, such as the United States. And as far as the regional countries are concerned, this includes certainly some Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, and also Turkey, in cooperation with the United States. And understandably, I mean, it's quite logical that in at the beginning of a civil conflict, it is much more difficult to reach or to contain such a conflict if each of the conflicting parties is getting or is knowing that they will have support from outside in case they are facing any difficulties on the ground in the country. So these interventions or this secret support, it was mostly a secret support, have made the conflict much more serious and have made it much more difficult to contain it. But now, 6 years after the fighting has started, the situation is that those countries that have been intervening have a responsibility now to bring the warring factions to the negotiating table. And they are in a position to do that. They can exercise influence on those groups which they have initially supported.
And you've suggested the trilateral mechanism between Russia, Turkey and Iran might offer a model of how other global conflicts may be resolved in future. But is that not simply going to undermine the credibility and indeed the relevance of the United Nations?
It may undermine the credibility of the United Nations, but I would say this is not the fault of those groups in the regions that take the initiative at peace negotiations. The problem is structural within the United Nations organization. The UN can only be effective on issues of conflict resolution if there is unanimity or consensus among the five permanent members. At the moment, there is no such consensus, particularly because in previous years, one or the other of the permanent members just did go it alone, so to speak, and did not act with the authorization of the Security Council. And in such a situation, when the World Organization is not able to decide in the form of coercive resolutions about a conflict or a dispute, it is only natural that the countries of the region who have a stake in the situation and who have also a concrete influence on the warring parties, that they become aware of their responsibility and that they negotiate, first of all, among themselves how to define their interests in a particular conflict, and secondly, they take an influence, exercise an influence on the local parties to negotiate with the mediation or facilitation of those regional countries. And that is what happened in Astana, and that is what I would call a form of realpolitik, and I would would also say, of responsible realpolitik, because those who have a stake and who have also exercised influence on one or the other groups at the same time have a responsibility to help those fighting groups to negotiate and to reach a compromise.
You've suggested the UN system of collective security has proven, quotes, dysfunctional. Is the UN Security Council still fit for purpose, or does the international community need to completely reform the long-established institutions of the United Nations?
I think the system is outdated. Now, in the year 2017, the global power balance is different from the one that existed in 1945. But the structure of the United Nations still somehow represents the power balance of a bygone era. Now it would be time for the United Nations to reform the charter. However, the prospects of such a reform are dim, because any changes to the charter, which would be required, any changes do need the consent of exactly those five powers who have the status of permanent members, who have had that status since 1945.
Professor Cochlear, a very interesting contribution. Many thanks for speaking to us on World in Focus.
You're welcome.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
It's 30 minutes past the hour. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. The Trump administration has recently signed off on $100 billion to enhance an underground silo of nuclear weapons as part of America's so-called deterrence strategy. The weapons are stored in underground silos and spread out across five states in the Midwest, but strangely, their purpose is to never be used. For more on this, here's Matthew Aiton.
The United States of America currently has hundreds of nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles laid in underground silos across Colorado, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Wyoming. Each of the missiles is packed with a nuclear payload that reportedly has more destructive potential than the nuclear weapon that was dropped on Hiroshima at the turn of World War II. As if that wasn't enough, it has been reported that the Pentagon is now planning to upgrade this generation of missiles, but has no intention of actually ever using them, not even in a nuclear exchange. The purpose of these missiles is to be destroyed while underground, to absorb any nuclear attack from a great power, namely Russia, which has given this ground-based network of missiles the name Nuclear Sponge. The logic of drawing attacks toward the United States rather than away from it, in an effort to exhaust the capabilities of the adversary, is a logic that permeates Cold War strategic thinking. But even during that time, analysts challenged the idea as madness and risking possible state suicide. Not only does the United States still have this system in place, but the Trump administration is planning to funnel $100 billion to revamp the project and adding new missiles to the current stock. The incumbent Secretary of Defense James Mattis has defended the Nuclear Sponge program, saying during his Senate confirmation hearing on January the 12th that, quote, the ICBM force provides a cost-imposing strategy on an adversary.
I consider the deterrent to be critical, Senator, because we don't ever want those weapons used. And so either the deterrent is safe and secure, it is compelling, or we actually open the door for something worse, whether it be an accident, technical accident, or a political accident. So to me, it's of absolute priority.
That was American Secretary of Defense James Mattis. However, the United States isn't the only one with this kind of system in place. Russia allegedly maintains its own program of intercontinental ballistic missiles to deter the possibility of a US-NATO nuclear first strike, known as Dead Man's Hand. The Dead Man's Hand was created during the days of the Soviet Union and is a computer system that can automatically launch all of Russia's nuclear weapons at once at an adversary in a retaliatory strike, even if the Russian leadership have expired. Well, joining us now to try and make sense of all of this is Professor Paul Rogers from the University of Bradford, who has spent time researching America's nuclear deterrent. Professor Rogers, thanks a lot for joining us here on Sputnik Radio. So just for the sake of clarity, could you please explain what the US's nuclear sponge mission actually is and how it's supposed to work?
Well, the point is, it is very controversial whether it is to be called a sponge. Essentially, the United States has three legs to its strategic triad: the land-based ICBMs, the long-range nuclear bombers, and the sea-based Trident missiles on the big submarines. The land-based missiles are basically housed in five Midwest states, and it's undoubtedly true that if there was a central nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia, then Russia would certainly be trying to destroy those missiles if they hadn't already been fired, and the same would be the other way around. So the Russian missile fields would come under very early attack from the United States. So there is a view that, in a sense, these two sets of missile fields, which spread over many, many thousands of square kilometers, are in a way a sponge to absorb some of the other side's nuclear weapons. In one sense, it is certainly true that if there is a war, these will be the earliest parts of both countries to be basically obliterated. There's no doubt about that. But it is not the intention for them to be sponges, because, as I say, the missiles would have been fired almost certainly before the opposing missiles arrived.
So essentially the idea is to draw in or absorb a Russian attack, but how would sacrificing five states and the tens of millions of civilians who live in them be of any strategic advantage?
Well, the point is that you have this opinion, and it's true on both sides, both Russia and the United States, that if it came to the worst of the worst, then a nuclear war would be survivable. You might have only 30 or 40 million people left out of the previous populations of, well, in Russia's case, 145 million, in the United States, over 300 million. But as long as they were sort of more powerful in the post-nuclear war world, then basically, if they'd absorbed a lot of the other side's missiles in remote places, and the case of both Russia and America, then that would be part of the purpose. But this is all to do with the extraordinary logic that nuclear wars are survivable, which is utter nonsense, because if you had any kind of central nuclear exchange involving the two main nuclear powers, you would have this appalling nuclear winter, which would basically render more or less the whole of the Northern Hemisphere unable to grow food for probably 3 or 4 years. So in many ways, it's part of the nonsense that you had during the Cold War period, and to some extent it is a nonsense returning with the very high states of tension that you have between Russia and the United States.
U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis actually defended the so-called nuclear sponge during his Senate confirmation hearing, saying that it provides a cost-imposing strategy. But would you agree, surely any cost paid in the scenario of a nuclear exchange between Russia and the United States would be Russian and American civilians?
Certainly. I mean, but this is true on both sides. You know, the people who live in Russia in the very big missile fields or close to them would similarly suffer. This is a two-way thing, but it is part of this extraordinary, I would have to say, almost mad logic which goes right back to the Cold War. And I would have to say that this is true of both sides. And the real issue is the sort of interchange between the two. And you get this extraordinary logic. In fact, a famous American Secretary of State for Defense, I think it was, actually wrote a book called With Enough Shovels. And his view was that you could have a good enough civil defense system to actually survive a nuclear war. That is really at the root of this, a belief that one side or other can come out victorious from a central nuclear exchange. That, I think, is the most dangerous thing of all.
Well, before becoming Defense Secretary, Mattis is actually quoted as saying that removing the land-based missiles would reduce the false alarm danger, in other words, the deployment of an atomic weapon by mistake. Has this actually happened before? Does it have precedent?
Oh, there's certainly been many examples where there have been some, you know, extraordinary mistakes. So obviously, we've never had an accidental nuclear launch. We never had an accidental nuclear detonation. But some of the problems have been extraordinary. Some of the accidents and the near misses have been remarkable. We know most about what has happened at sea, because in a sense that is more easily in the public domain, because it's outside of the territory of either country. We're reasonably clear about some of the accidents on the United States side, much less clear of the old Soviet Union, which in international terms is a lot more secretive. But there's enough evidence to know that, for example, a number of nuclear weapons have been lost at sea and never recovered. There have been several cases in which there was a suspicion that, in fact, nuclear missiles were uncomfortably close to launch, although it never actually happened. And there was a famous case where, back in the 1990s, Moscow actually mistook an American launch of a test research rocket off the coast of Norway for a sea-launched ballistic missile, because the early signature on the radar was rather similar. Although we've never had any kind of nuclear exchange, the Cold War never went hot, there were some very near misses, and that is one certainly very good reason for working for a degree of basically bilateral nuclear drawdown, if not disarmament.
We hear a lot in nuclear discourse about the theory of mutually assured destruction, which says essentially that the annihilation guaranteed by a nuclear attack and its response deters all states from actually using nuclear weapons. Do you think this theory is the best way to explain why atomic bombs haven't been used since Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
To some extent, yes, but of course the problem with all of this is that that doesn't allow for mistakes and errors. When you get into a state of crisis between two states, you fear basically an acronym, AIM, A-I-M, which stands for accidents, incidents, and mavericks, the kinds of things that can push a crisis into something worse. And the problem is that, in a sense, relying on mutually assured destruction basically relies on perfection in human relations. And as somebody remarked many years ago, it's rather like somebody jumping off the top of a very high building and three-quarters of the way down to the ground shouting out, "So far, so good." You can only go so far without accidents and incidents. And this is why, as I say, one has to be very cautious about believing in mutually assured destruction. And in any case, during that period of the Cold War, we had many proxy wars fought between East and West right across the world, from Vietnam to Afghanistan. And those wars collectively killed 10 million people and injured at least 25 million.
Okay, Professor Paul Rogers, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, with less than 2 weeks until the Dutch general election, many commentators are predicting a shift towards far-right populism in the Netherlands following the rise of Geert Wilders' Freedom Party. But has the Wilders phenomenon been overblown, and why is nobody talking about the simultaneous surge in support for left-leaning pro-Europe parties? More on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to question to worry him. Give him one, better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, "Oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them."
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme. With less than 2 weeks until the Dutch general election, many commentators are predicting a shift towards far-right populism in the Netherlands following the rise of Geert Wilders' Freedom Party. But has the Wilders phenomenon been overblown, and why is nobody talking about the simultaneous surge in support for left-leaning pro-Europe parties? And we'll be speaking about Freddy and Bubbles, who were given a Viking send-off like no other you've ever seen before. It's 43 minutes past the hour. This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. I'm Carolyn Scott. It's just under 2 weeks till the Netherlands goes to the polls for a general election, and with so many of their European neighbours in a state of political flux, the Dutch are being touted as a bellwether in terms of the trend of right-wing populism that seems to be sweeping the continent. But just how likely is it that the Netherlands will take a leap to the right on March 15th? Jack Foster has been finding out.
If you were looking for a metaphor for the Netherlands poster boy for the far right, Geert Wilders, you could do worse than his 2008 film Fitna. It's a 17-minute online video pieced together with all of the ham-fisted grace and filmmaking prowess of a broken sewage pipe. Fitna found itself mired in controversy and even legal challenges, which arguably blew out of proportion its significance considerably. That, combined with Wilders' growing reputation as leading the vanguard for the growing far right Islamophobic politics bubbling up in the traditionally liberal, progressive Netherlands, has propelled Wilders to the status of supposed frontrunner in this year's general election. It's a narrative which suits supporters of right-wing populism in Europe, looking for a domino effect from Brexit to Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen in France. Here is Wilders speaking during an interview with the UK's Sky News.
When it comes to immigration, we want, and that's in our party program since the first day that I started this party for freedom, is that we want to stop the immigration from Islamic countries.
Geert Wilders, leader of the Party voor de Vrijheid, or PVV, which translates to the Freedom Party, and during that same interview he spoke of his desire to take the Netherlands out of the European Union.
I believe that a democracy needs a nation state, and we have lost our nation state in the process of a more federalism in the European Union, you know? It started with economic cooperation and it became a political project, and we lost our national sovereignty. And I want the Dutch to be in charge of their own immigration policy, their own financial policy, their own budget policy, like the United Kingdom decided last year.
With a quiff of hair reminiscent of Donald Trump crossed with Gary Oldman's Dracula, Geert Wilders has become the face of the far right in the Netherlands and has perhaps unsurprisingly been extremely complimentary about US President Donald Trump and specifically his travel ban from Muslim countries.
I'm very happily surprised with politicians like Donald J. Trump. You know, it's a kind of refreshment, a fresh air in a room where the windows have been closed for too long. You know, we have in Holland, in Europe, in the rest of the Western world, we have especially a lot of politicians who are unable to deal with the mass immigration that we have faced in the last decades. And here there is a politician who does not only keep his promises and fulfills his promises in the election campaign, but has done more to beat the mass immigration in 2 weeks' time than the whole European governments in the whole existence.
What Geert Wilders doesn't touch on, of course, is the rise in racially aggravated hate crimes in Trump's America, and many in the Netherlands fear that the politics of Wilders' own Freedom Party could have a similar effect there. And if reporting on the upcoming Dutch elections is to be believed, the country, famous for its liberal politics and tolerant attitudes, is careering headfirst towards a populist right-wing revolution to rival the likes of Brexit in the UK and Trump in America. But polling in the Netherlands shows that voter intention spreads across over 10 political parties, and whilst the Freedom Party does lead a lot of polls, they've rarely broken the 30% mark. So, given that, and given the unwillingness of most parties to work with the PVV, has the rise and influence of Wilders and his party been overplayed? That's a question I put to Dr. Gijs Schumacher, assistant professor in political science at the University of Amsterdam.
There's almost no chance that he will become prime minister. There's nobody who wants to work with him, so there's no way he could form a coalition. And historically, there's never been a party that had a majority of the votes.
I mean, a lot of emphasis has been placed on that rise of Euroscepticism and Islamophobic attitudes in the Netherlands, and that exemplified by the policies of Geert Wilders. But one could perhaps argue the opposite equally well, that the pro-European left-of-centre parties such as Democraten, Zesenzestig, D66, are polling sometimes 7-8 points ahead of where they were in 2012. Yep. GroenLinks, Green Party, by some polls 15 points ahead of where they were in 2012. why are we not talking about a resurgence in the left and pro-EU sentiment in the Netherlands?
That's a very good question. Well, they're not leading the polls, so that might be one explanation. Mm. But I mean, yeah, if you would add the support of the two parties that you mentioned together, I mean, they outpace the Freedom Party. So, I mean, you're completely right. I mean, what we're seeing is a shift from, say, a debate that focuses around economic issues to a debate that focuses around cultural issues. So for a while, this was primarily seen by the rise of the Freedom Party, but by talking about immigration against Europe, this has mobilized people who are actually support these causes. And this is going at the expense of, say, the Labour Party and to the benefit of those sort of more pro-European and more pro-immigration parties on the left.
So is this coverage, which is imagining the Freedom Party as coming out on top and controlling the outcome of the election, is that a misunderstanding of what's going on? Is it a lazy reportage? Is there something more sinister going on? Or
I think the reason why people are reporting on this is that people see the Netherlands as sort of the next domino in line after the Brexit vote, after Trump. And it fits sort of a pattern of development in the Western world. I mean, still, even though that they might not end up in government, I mean, it's still quite likely that they will double their seat share in parliament. And I mean, that's still a tremendous gain. So, I mean, that would still sort of fit the story of a populist surge across the Western world.
Have we not heard in recent years about the rise of the right in the Netherlands, though? I mean, I remember this about 10 years ago, there was talk that the more traditionally liberal politics in the Netherlands was shifting towards the right.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen since the 90s, it started all with Pim Fortuyn shortly after 9/11. After he was murdered, of course, his movement disappeared. But, you know, soon after that was picked up by Geert Wilders, and there were a couple of other contenders for the throne, to call it like that. And now again, actually, we see many alternatives to the Freedom Party competing for the radical right vote. But again, it's partly is indeed the increase gain of the right, but it's also more appropriate to talk about a gain of conservative parties. And these have also mobilized the progressive parties. And that we're now in a situation where economics seems really to be not much of an issue in the elections, which is surprising since we're just at the end of a major economic crisis.
Dr. Gijs Schumacher there, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Amsterdam. And with just under 2 weeks until Dutch voters go to the polls, far-right populism has certainly been making inroads. But so too has the left, and so too that pro-European centre. The narrative in Europe right now has its roots in Brexit, France's Front National, and the spectre of Donald Trump. It's maybe therefore unsurprising that Geert Wilders' face fits that story, but it's almost certain that in a parallel universe, where none of those things had so clouded the collective media lens, that names like Alexander Pechtold of the pro-EU D66 or Jesse Klaver of the Green GL party might be considered just as worthy of headlines as those of Geert Wilders. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And Jack joins me in the studio now. Jack, the premise of your report there is that Geert Wilders is not going to win, but he is leading in the polls. I mean, he is technically going to win the election.
Well, no, I mean, the premise of the report is not so much that Geert Wilders is not going to win, but more that he is not the only party that is doing quite well. That obviously the PVV has become this sort of success story in the run-up to the election, and as I was talking about in there, I think a lot of that has to do with the narrative which exists in Europe, not just in Europe, but it's mainly in Europe at the moment as a result of Brexit and as a result of the upcoming French elections, Marine Le Pen, the sort of right-wing populism narrative that's going on. Obviously, people are going to be looking now to the Netherlands, especially the Netherlands, because it's traditionally a very progressive, very left-leaning country. So if they go to the right and they go to a Eurosceptic party, then that would certainly signify a major shift. Now, I don't think that is taking into account the whole story, because obviously, yes, it's true the PVV have been leading the polls, although a recent poll from just a week or so ago, actually, they dropped behind, but it was only one poll, so let's not get too carried away with that. They have been leading the polls for several months now, and on and off, in fact, for over a year. So
they are ahead, but let's remember that they're not really breaking the 30% mark in the polls. There's about over 10 parties there. And the important thing is that parties like D66 and the Greens are actually polling rather similarly to the PVV. Not so much in recent days, but certainly over the past couple of years, over the peace, they are doing quite well. And they are, of course, left-leaning, they are pro-EU, and their support has increased in this similar sort of time.
And are they likely to form a coalition, those two parties? What kind of coalitions could we be looking at?
Well, it's difficult to say. Now, I would premise this by saying that I can only base this on people I've spoken to. I'm not an expert on the Netherlands politics myself. But from what I understand, there's probably a couple of likely options. What will probably happen is a coalition that would involve Christian Democrats and D66 and the Liberals plus some other party, depending on what the mathematics are of the results that come through. Or there's also talk of something involving Labour and the Socialists and the Greens. What there is no talk of is a coalition involving the PVV. So, I mean, that is where the whole argument of Geert Wilders having some sort of populist right-wing revolution kind of falls apart, because no one is willing to work with them.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to be the most popular among the other parties.
I mean, he could probably reach out and get some support, but not enough to make any kind of inroads into a majority. I mean, he's currently polling between 20 and 30%. That's not going to be enough.
Well, I'm sure we'll have more on that in the run-up to that election. Thank you very much, Jack.
Above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 55 minutes past the hour. And finally for today, Bubbles and Freddy were the goldfish gifted to a class of five-year-olds by their teacher. Unfortunately, Freddy and Bubbles both passed away last month. Their departure coincided with a new history project on the Vikings for the school, for the children at Kirkwall's Papdale School in Shetland. Shetland is, of course, home to the huge festival Uphelia, and in keeping with the traditions of Uphelia, the children decided to give the fish a Viking send-off, building them a little cardboard Viking ship and setting it on fire before sending them off to sea.
Carolyn.
Jack.
Run that past me again.
Bubbles and Freddy were goldfish that passed away at a school in Kirkwall in Shetland, in Scotland. And the children decided to give them a Viking send-off because they were their beloved pets and they wanted to see them have this incredible Viking send-off.
This is the And Finally Stories, setting fire
Jack,
to goldfish.
You know what the And Finally Stories are like. Okay? This is a nice story. They wanted to do well by their favourite pet fish.
I'm assuming that the goldfish had died first, though.
They had died first. Okay. That's a horrible thing to say.
No, that would have been horrific.
Well, on that note, that is unfortunately all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. We'll be back with you tomorrow, 11 a.m. UK time, 2 p.m. in Moscow for World in Focus Weekly, where I'll be joined by Jack Foster and Mark Hurst for a slightly more informal look back at the big stories over the past
week. This has been so formal today.
Until then, this is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartmann Show. For now, though, from me, Carolyn Scott and Jack Foster.
Bye.
Goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartmann.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. they end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they send me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.